Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm a mom of three kids, ages 2, 5, and 7, and I live in Southern California.
And I'm Megan. I am the mom of 5 kids, ages 6 through 17, and I live in Michigan. This is the Mom Hour, part of the Life Listened Network. Hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 42 of the Mom Hour. I'm Megan Francis, here as always with Sarah Powers. Hey, Sarah, how are you?
I'm great, Megan. How are you?
I'm pretty good. The weather here is nice. I'm liking it. For March, I cannot complain.
Early spring.
Yes. Isn't it funny how we talk about the weather so often when we start the show? It just seems like one of those things everybody can relate to or be bored by.
Be bored by. And I feel like you represent a big portion of the Midwest, and I've got some West Coast, Southwest. So there've got to be people out there appreciating.
There's probably people listening to this, you know, in Australia or something who are like,
that's true.
Guys, this is not relevant to my life.
What is your weather like in Australia?
We want to know. Today we are talking about hard times in parenting, something that, you know, we don't really talk about a lot on this show. We keep it pretty upbeat. And maybe that's just because we're both in fairly upbeat periods of life. And maybe that's just because we're upbeat kind of people. I don't know. But that doesn't represent the full spectrum of the motherhood experience.
Or definitely. Even our motherhood experience.
No, that's what I'm saying.
For that matter, yeah.
Yeah. Just because I'm like in a good place when I talk to Sarah once a week does not mean I'm in a good place all the rest of the time. So.
Agreed. And I have to confess, I like was feeling a little like worried about what we were going to talking about parenting through harder times. And I realized it's very similar to when we talked about race and racism. We kind of felt like we don't know if we're going to say the right things, but we feel like we should do it anyway. And I feel like this topic is right in that same spot where it's like, we're not mental health professionals. We know we can't talk about everything relating to hard times and motherhood, but it feels like it's better to say something than pretend things are happy and hunky-dory all the time.
Yeah, that's very true. And there's a big spectrum of hard times from like, you know, just your average everyday little irritants that build up over time to something, you know, more difficult to deal with. So we can cover a wide range.
Yeah.
So let's do that.
Do it. But first, let's do our regular segment, which is answering the question, what's happening in your house this week?
Well, I'm going to answer that with something that's kind of a bummer.
Okay.
Just to set things off on the right note.
Let's do it.
Clara has been having some really bad school-related anxiety, and it's come out of nowhere, and she doesn't want to go to school. She cries all the time. She comes home and is kind of obsessed with not doing things right.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
I know. And she's in first grade. It's really bumming me out, and I've definitely dealt with kid anxiety as it relates to school, but never in first grade. This is new. And I've talked to a lot of different parents, in the same school and different schools, and I'm hearing that this is becoming more common because curriculums are becoming so much more, I don't know what the word is, I guess standardized isn't even the right word. Rigorous.
Back to basics, academic, right?
It's just becoming a lot harder both for the teachers and for the kids.
And at younger ages.
And at younger ages. So for us, first grade was all about like learning to read. If you don't learn to read now by the end of kindergarten, and it's kind of like you're already behind the eight ball. So I think that, I don't know, there's just kind of a lot. We have our conference actually this afternoon. So maybe I'll have something to report in a future episode, but it just breaks my heart. You know, she's very sweet and very sensitive and kind of a handful at times, but it bums me out that something that should be fun is not fun for her.
Do you ever remember having any similar thoughts in school when you were little? Or that type of stuff? No.
No, maybe social stuff more.
Yeah.
I never really felt anxious about academics, but I just think academics were a totally different ball of wax when we were in school. It just wasn't the same thing. I mean, I feel like first grade was a lot about play and, you know, kind of learning to get along with other kids and... So, yeah. And the funny thing is she does fine. It's not like she can't do the work. She does fine, but she has all this built up anxiety about maybe making a mistake.
Oh.
So, and I've, you know, not to get into like a big educational spiel right now, but I have been reading that that's a common thing now that kids are afraid to make mistakes. So they don't think outside the box or they don't take risks. And that, you know, that's not really okay with me. I'm not really sure what to do about it.
Yeah.
But I guess this first step is going in and talking to the teacher.
And I feel for the teachers too, because I believe that so many of them aren't on board with,
with some
of these philosophies. It's kind of heartbreaking for teachers too, because
They're stuck.
And so many of them probably could be been much better teachers if their hands weren't tied. Yeah. Wow, we could really go to town. On
Hey, if anybody out there has opinions, and I'm sure, I mean, this is one of those topics that people always have opinions about. Definitely yeah. leave
and
us a comment.
And I know we have a lot of teacher listeners too. Yes. So, oh, sweet Clara. Okay. Well, keep us posted.
I will. What's up with you?
I know. I'm glad you shared something. Well, I have two little things, and one of them is really not that fun either.
Oh, all
and right. That one is that my threw my back out this weekend.
Oh my gosh.
It happens about once or twice a year. And it's, I guess, related to my dance career. Although I didn't have back problems when I was dancing. It was all after I stopped. Mm-hmm. And it's like a known issue. Like I know which discs are compressed and I know what to do to kind of get it back on track. But just going into this topic of parenting through like crappy times, it's just, it reminds you every time how like you think things are stressful or difficult or you have a lot of laundry. And then like, if you can literally not even put on your own underwear because it hurts so much to bend over, like things are just a lot harder. And it just gives you that kind of perspective on whether it's illness or injury or anything, any kind of major like handicap in that way, it just makes things a lot harder. Luckily, we didn't have a lot going on this weekend and Brian was home. So I basically lie around with ice on my back for 2 days, but it's such a bummer. It just can really, I find my mood is really affected, and I know I should be able to kind of rise above that, but I just get so grumpy because I can't do anything. I can't unload the dishwasher. Yeah. I can't. So it's better today. I would say it's at like a 4 or a 5 today instead of like an 8 or a 9. So that really sucked this weekend.
It does. You know, and it, honestly, I have to say the couple of times that I've had something wrong with me that, you know, was painful or whatever, it made me so much more compassion for people who deal with chronic pain all the time or mobility issues. It's so frustrating.
It is and so frustrating.
You don't really think about how much we take our bodies for granted until you suddenly can't do something.
Yeah. And the simple things like chores and taking care of a house, which I feel grumbly about a lot of the time, like, oh, come on guys, let's pick up this. It's like, I almost would love now to just schlep a bunch of loads of laundry back and forth. To the
like if I can't have,
it's like, I'm sorry, I never complained about picking up toys. I now just want to do it without being in pain. So anyway, I think I'm on the right track, but that sucked. And then the other thing that made me laugh this weekend is we dyed Easter eggs, which I know it's really early, but I found a little bit leftover Easter egg dye stuff in this bin of kind of a few spring and Easter decorations. And it made me remember that you and I are totally aligned on how you should dye Easter eggs with your children. I think you even had a Facebook post about this last year. But that is, if you're newer, if you have little kids and you haven't dyed Easter eggs with your children, please take this advice from Megan and Sarah. And that is, open the grocery store dye kit in privacy away from your children and throw away all of the extra things that come with it. All the stickers, all the weird shrink wrap things that never work.
The weird shrink wrap ones are the one. Those are just, I can't abide.
I mean, a wax crayon here or there, maybe. I think we could allow for a wax.
I will sometimes slip the stickers into Clara's like art supplies, and she can use those at a later time.
Exactly.
But those shrink wrap things are useless. I don't get it. They don't work.
And
they're difficult.
Children love like gimmicks and shiny objects and marketing madness. That's what they go for immediately.
Right.
And all of a sudden, like the simple act of dropping an egg in the colored solution is like they almost care more about like the Batman shrink wraps or whatever.
Yes.
So that's a tip for all of you going into Easter season. And what's funny is I had saved only the little dye things and a couple of the dippers because it had been left over from last year. So I didn't have any of the other stuff. And it was such like it was so easy. There was no accoutrement. So
I love that. And I guess the other tip I would give is always save the dippers.
Yeah.
Those feel like the thing that I always need more than anything else. And never have enough.
Yeah, we had two that were left over in this, and it worked great. All three kids could dye eggs, and they look pretty, and you don't need shrink wrapped nonsense.
No, no nonsense.
We hate fun. Remember from previous.
And half the time, like let's face it, your kid's gonna end up with an egg that's like half brown because they just throw it in like 4 different cups of color, and you know they're not in this to create.
This
art.
Is not Pinterest worthy.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
So should we get into it? Yeah, let's do it.
Deep breath. All right. Well, we're going to talk about the hard times, and that's parenting through the hard times. And I think it's kind of helpful maybe to talk about what we're talking about. I think there's several things at work you mentioned. There's kind of like your regular mom funk, which is when you just kind of feel like you're in a funk, or you've kind of going through one of those cycles of low energy. And you actually have written some great posts about this that I'm going to bring up as we talk. But that's kind of like one thing that we're talking about. Another thing I think that we'll probably touch on as we go is what I'll call like times of crisis or trauma. And that is when like something, whether it's like a separation, a divorce, an illness in the family, a death in the family, that's kind of, I think, a different kind of hard time. It's maybe a heightened, everything's heightened, but it might be a different, it has, I don't know, not a beginning and an end, but it's around a specific event, I guess. Yeah.
They call it, isn't it situational?
You know, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. So
not a mental health professional. I don't have the right words. And then I think we'll definitely touch on kind of big picture mental health challenges, which is like postpartum depression, depression and anxiety, and things that fall under that umbrella of kind of where you need support for mental health reasons, yep. Big or small. So those are kind of, do you feel like those are kind of the things we're talking about? And this is too much to conquer in 1 hour, but that's kind of like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Those are I guess those would be the three buckets I'd put it in as well.
Yeah.
So, awesome. And the thing is that sometimes one spills into the next, and that's, totally. You know, you can't really do anything about that. But yeah, like if you're having postpartum depression, all the little irritants.
Yes.
Can really build up and yes. create something much bigger than they would if you were just in kind of a normal stage. So yeah, anyway, but let's do it that way. It's a good way to organize it.
Okay. Well, let's kind of start small and talk about the funk. Can you define a mom funk? You've written quite a bit. I mean,
for me, a funk feels very different now than it did. And I thought about that. Why does a funk feel so different for me now? With my youngest being almost 7, and this week, by the way, and my oldest being 18. And I think the difference is that now I can get a break from it. I don't literally have small people crawling on me. So when I can send them off to school or whatever, it gives me a kind of a moment to hit the reset button. And that was, and when I thought about that, like why did funks feel so funky 5+ years ago? It was because I was in it and parenting at the exact same time, and yes. there was like no escape, you know? Yeah. So for me, a funk would be those days where you just get up and nothing sounds good. Like you don't want to do the things. You don't really want to try that hard. You don't want to make dinner. You don't really want to change the diaper. You don't want to play with your kids. Like you just, none of it sounds inspiring, fun, important, or does feel important, but you just can't bring yourself to do it, and you kind of spiral.
Yeah.
No, I guess that's my.
No, I think that's a really good definition. And I think like we said, there's a lot of times where a prolonged funk can definitely go into the territory of some bigger mental health issues, but it also might not. It may. Right. I think one of the most helpful things is to acknowledge, and you've written about this too, that this is cyclical. Like we don't need to expect of ourselves that we're high energy and productive and like super engaged in life all the time.
Right.
And I think acknowledging that cyclical funks are normal and keeping an eye out for bigger symptoms that might need more support, but acknowledging that cycles are normal, whether it's a 6-month cycle or a 1-week funk.
They can often be related to weather for me, and honestly, hormones. Yep. That's how I pronounce the word hormones now. Hormonal cycles. You know, I think that's also something that sometimes we don't pay that close of attention to, but can have a huge effect on how we feel about regular life.
Yeah. Well, and I think something that can come with a funk is just a lot of resistance, to use some pop culture lingo, and feeling like I got to get out of this, or I got to get over this, and then some guilt about now, you know, if I'm not at my best, I'm screwing up my kids, or, you know, I'm letting people down. So those are a lot of tricky things that come with a funk. And I think the more we can just be the funk, just acknowledge the funk, and kind of
become one with the funk,
trust that it will pass. But you have written about some specific kind of tactics for moving through that. And I'll just read a couple. One was to indulge in healthy, comforting rituals. And I think healthy is a key word here, because when you're in a funk, it's really easy to like escape on bad TV and bad food and bad internet. Which kind of provides that immediate escape, but
usually ends up just adding to the spiral.
Yeah. Yeah. And more guilt and less energy. So, you know, you in your, in this post that I'll link to in the show notes, you talk about, you know, going for a walk or getting outside. So kind of defining for yourself what a healthy and comforting ritual would be, which might be different than what you want to do, like just lay in bed. So, and then you also said to embrace and improve reality. And that's kind of what we're just talking about, which is to say, this is where I am right now. And that doesn't mean I can't take baby steps out of this funk. But you use the example of spending the better part of a day looking at travel deals to get somewhere warmer during one winter funk. Which is, again, like if you're not going to probably book that ticket that day, that might be a little more avoidance than anything. Whereas if you just kind of acknowledge where you are and take small steps to improve the current reality, might be a better tactic.
Yeah. And I think there's lots of ways we can do that that don't have to include spending money. Although sometimes a little retail therapy, it's like, it's that spiral, right? It can be like a nice scented hand lotion. Sometimes puts me in a really good mood. I mean, it's a dumb thing, but it gets me out of my house and doing something for myself and out of my routine. And it just feels like a little indulgence. You know, this is not really exactly what we're talking about, although kind of is. And I just wanted to bring this up because I read this article, and this is maybe a little more of a radical approach. Not even an approach. It's more like just a mindset. Mm-hmm. It wasn't specifically about moms. It was maybe in the New York Times, like, I want to say 6 months to a year ago. And it was about women's feelings. And this, I think she was a therapist. Her point was, if you find yourself really being really, really grumpy, like, you know, during while you're having PMS or it's like something cyclical for you having to do with your hormones, maybe you're not the problem. Maybe you're not being treated very well, or your situation isn't great all the time and you're just tolerating it.
Oh, that's really
the rest of the time. And then you just hit a breaking point because you get to a point where you're just more fragile.
You have less tolerance.
Less tolerance. Yeah. And her point was, you know, we look at women's feelings and we try to, and I mean, I don't even want to say medicate them away because that sounds a little bit like I'm dismissive of medication, which I'm totally not, but we see the women's feelings as a problem, like women having big feelings one way or the other. And sometimes it's just the situation you're in maybe needs to be changed. And she was a little combative in the article. It was kind of like, you know, putting up with men's crap was like the problem women are all going through, and they're the problem, not us. And okay, maybe that's sometimes true. But we still have to live with the people that surround us and the lives that we have. But I think sometimes if you're finding that you're freaking out like monthly or anytime something gets really hard, you fall apart, not really hard, but like there's that tipping point, like that straw that breaks the camel's back. Maybe it is makes sense to take a step back and go, maybe overall, this isn't sustainable, whatever it is you're doing. And you're just choosing, you're only able
you're
to
unraveling
kind of fall apart
when you reach the tipping point, but the issues are there.
Regardless.
That's fascinating.
You're putting your head down and powering through the rest of the time because you can't, but then there's that breaking point.
That's such a classic thing that I think a lot of women do is assume that we have to, that functioning at our best is the way things have to be. Right. So then if we're not, there's something wrong with us rather than the opposite, that we shouldn't have to function at our best to get through the current reality.
Just
Does
to
that
power
make sense?
Through. Yeah, absolutely. I'll find that article and link to it because I thought it was pretty fascinating and a very different way of looking at things like coping and feelings and depression and all kinds of stuff than what we're used to seeing. I think that often there's this focus on like just getting through like whatever you got to do to get through the day and that somehow that we're the problem. And I think sometimes it is whatever, you know, our schedules or expectations or our partner is not helping us or, you know, our kids are being crappy, which we can't do a lot about, but you know,
or we don't have enough like creative challenge, you know, like inspiration type stuff there, you know?
Yeah. We don't have a strong enough social circle or whatever it is. I mean, there's lots of different things that it could be. But if it's a recurring problem and it's the same recurring problem, I think it's worth looking into.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's great. I want to go back to something you said about a really fun scented hand lotion or those little things. Yeah. There's a writer that I will link to who I just love. You and I met her at Mom 2.0 a couple years ago. Her name's Jessica Michelson, and she's a therapist by a training, but she does all kinds of writing and articles and coaching for women, and I think she's great. But one of the points she makes a lot is to pay attention to what brings you sensory pleasure, meaning things that are pleasing to your eyes or your body or your sense of smell or your ears. And I think that's such a specific way to think about those little, and it might sound trivial, but I don't think it is, those little things that perk you up or energize you. And if you, I'm very cerebral. I'm in my head a lot. So paying attention to sensory pleasures, and that includes, it can include socks, like really nice socks that feel really good on your feet, or music. Like for me, music is a really good sensory mood pick me up. But because I tend to exist in my head, I think I'm prone to forget about those sensory pleasures. And just for some reason, phrasing it that way is thinking, okay, what would feel good to my body right now? Whether it's like the type of food or exercise, or, and to pay attention to the little ways you can have more of that in your day, I think is really helpful getting through, whether we're talking about big hard times or small hard times. We should all have more things that smell good and feel good.
I totally agree. It's very important. And, you know, on the flip side, I think it's really easy to get used to things that are displeasing, like your pants are too tight.
So true.
Or, you know, the lighting in your house is bad. Yes. Or there's just different like little things that I think we sometimes just accept and deal with that we have the power to make a change. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to sneeze. Oh. Oh my goodness, this is like the fourth episode of Sneezedom. What is going
sneezing
on?
Sneezing is a sensory pleasure, though.
I love to
sneeze. Sneezing feels really good.
I could have actually stopped that sneeze, but I chose not to because I wanted to experience
lean
it.
Leaned
into the sneeze. But just things, you know, there's a lot of little things that I think we just put up with. We don't like the way a color of a wall in our room, and we think it, or in our house, we think it doesn't matter and it shouldn't be a big deal. But we, I think, underestimate, especially moms who work from home or are stay-at-home moms, how much our environments affect us, and the clothes that we're wearing, and all that, and how we feel about the way things look and smell and sound. Mm-hmm. So, good tip, Sarah.
Good tip. We'll hat tip that one to Jessica Michelson, and I will link to all her website and blog posts. She's wonderful.
She's great.
For hard times. I want to kind of shift to talking about how we, or when we talk about when things are hard. I think this is a big issue for moms, and especially newer moms. I'm finding as I move through motherhood that women are a lot more honest about when things are crappy. But I think in the first few years, especially, it's very hard to just say, you know, I'm having a hard time right now. And I had forgotten that I wrote a post about this because it was in when I was totally in a hard time, when I had 3 kids, 5 and under. But I wrote a post for The Happiest Home called Why Is It So Hard to Say This Is Hard? And I'll link to it. But the point was kind of, we rationalize why we shouldn't be having a hard time. Like, you know, well, I should be grateful because most things are just fine right now. Everybody's healthy, you know, no, but we don't have any major crises going on. So I don't deserve to feel this way. That's one thing I think we do a lot. Moms do a lot. Another one is that somebody else has it way harder. And I do this all the time. It's like, well, yeah, I threw my back out this weekend and that sucked and this and that. But, you know, I have a really supportive husband and XYZ. So you sort of like scorecard it to where you feel like it's not okay to say out loud, I'm having a hard time, because somehow somebody else has it harder.
To be fair, moms are can be very guilty of one-upping each other on who's got it harder. So it's not just that you're feeling a little guilty about feeling bad when other people have it harder. It's that sometimes especially I've noticed in certain phases of motherhood, it becomes almost like, you know, that there's that sort of switch back and forth between not ever complaining and then the like complaining marathon.
Right, the bitch fest.
Yes, exactly. Where it kind of becomes like a pile up and a pile on. And it depends a lot, I think, on the stage you're in, the group that you're hanging with, like what platform you're on. If you're on Facebook, I think you might see more complaining, you know, but you're also going to see a lot of like bragging. So it's like that weird, it's hard to find the stuff in the middle, right? Yeah. So definitely, I think that is for sure one of the reasons we don't talk about it. And I was going to say, I think sometimes there's phases of motherhood where we don't want to look like we don't know what we're doing, or we think that if we admit that we're having a hard time, that means we're somehow not doing a good job.
Yeah. Or that we're not grateful or not like, you know, kind of like you got yourself in this mess. Like you wanted 3 kids close together, so you don't get to complain. I mean, I think that was my story. And, you know, I also struggled with this one, which is I don't want people, I have like a history of not wanting people to worry about me. Mm-hmm. So I often will not say, you know, things are kind of hard right now because I'm afraid people are going to jump to the worst possible right. conclusion, like, and send me off to the funny farm or something. You know what I mean? Like,
well, and some people might. I mean, yeah. I think you do have to be somewhat, because I'm the same way. I don't want people to worry about me. There's actually nothing more annoying to me than sort of, I don't mind like well-placed concern, especially if I'm admitting to something that's really hard for me. But I don't like people just assuming things and like feeling sorry, like that pity feeling. Yeah, I have a really
casseroles. Like, is that weird?
No, I am the same way. I mean, it has to be like commensurate with the crisis. So like when I had surgery a few years ago, I love that people gave me like virtual handholding and brought me food that made me feel really cared for. And it was a really kind of emotionally hard time, vulnerable time of my life. I don't want to be that vulnerable all the time. Like,
right.
Sometimes I just kind of want to power through. But there are people that I feel like you can select those people
yes.
that you can share those things with who aren't going to freak out and who yes. aren't going to over respond or overreact.
Right. Right. And I think there are some people, I think, who a lot of their own self-worth is tied up in being a helper. And yeah. That's not a judgment, but there are the people who will show up with casseroles all the time. And I think you and I are probably the same, where we resist that a little bit. We just want to be able to say things are hard and I'm doing okay. Does that right. make sense?
Yeah, so like, totally.
Maybe it's just about knowing yourself and also acknowledging that the people who are going to worry or, you know, really want to support, it comes from a good place. They're doing the best they can. And it's not about, you know, it's not about you needing or not needing that extra support.
Right.
But all of this is to say we have a hard time saying I'm having a hard time, or a lot of us do. And I think if we can get over that and choose the right people to be upfront with and even just be upfront with ourselves, it's almost always better. Wouldn't you agree to say totally I'm having agree. A hard time than say everything's fine when it's
well,
not.
And everything's fine is also leads to the, it helps create the culture of everybody always saying everything's fine.
Right.
So,
right. Exactly.
But yeah, I think you can just be, it's kind of like, who would you walk into a room and tell a dirty joke to? You know, you choose your audience, right? And I think it's the same kind of thing. You choose your audience. If you really need a lot of support and a lot of love and that feels like it would really be helpful, maybe you widen your audience and you're less right. selective. And
right.
if you really just kind of want to vent a little bit and you want right. someone to go, ugh, that sucks, sorry. And that's it. That's all the reaction you want. You find that person.
Right.
You know,
right.
We all know who those people are in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And hopefully you have some of each.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And whatever you do, saying it out loud to somebody is, I think, almost always better than not saying it all. So even if you send us an email saying, my life is kind of hard right now, and we just say, I'm so sorry, that really sucks,
we probably won't send you a casserole.
We will not show up at your door with a casserole.
I hope that that's okay with you. I'm just letting you know that's not going to happen. But I will definitely give you a whole, so sorry, that sucks.
Yes. Fist bump.
Yeah.
So let's maybe move into talking a little bit about when things really do suck. You wrote a really very honest post about, it's actually, the post is called Designing a Life You Love. And it concludes with kind of one of your, I just read a Brené Brown book, so I'm going to borrow this phrase, like face down moments where you realize, like, this is not the way I want my life to be. Do you want to like tell a short version of that story? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think was it the one where I'm like slumped over my car steering wheel?
I think so. Yes.
In a parking lot in Park, by the way. I'm not like, didn't get an accident.
Yeah. It was about your kind of poor single mom days, for lack of a better term. And just kind of realizing like, this is not what I want my life to be.
Yeah.
But you actually kind of described in a lot of detail what was hard during that time. So.
Yeah. I mean, the parts I can remember, and of course, this is one of those posts I wrote, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. But so basically this was describing a point in my life when I was single mom. I had a 5 and 3-year-old, maybe, Isaac and Jacob. My husband, John, and I were divorced for over a year. And this was during that time. And I had just, you know, 9-to-5 job, and they were in daycare, and I had no money. And I was kind of holding things together most of the time. But I was like one of those moms who always feels like I was never quite on it. Like, the kids were going to a Montessori school. You know, in hindsight, in retrospect, I might have done myself a favor and picked a school that had fewer demands on the parents because there was extremely demanding. Like, they weren't allowed to have any packaged snacks in their lunches. And half the time we'd get halfway to school and I'd realize, like, I didn't have enough stuff for their lunch in the morning. So I had to stop at the store and, you know, but I couldn't buy anything. I couldn't buy any convenience food. So I'd have to, like, go to the produce aisle. I mean, it was really stressful. They had to have, like, a snack or a nature thing. Like, once a week they had to bring a nature share in. And I would literally be standing in the parking lot of our apartment complex, very little nature, and be like yelling at the kids, go get a stick or a rock. I mean, it was exactly the opposite of what I'm sure the intent was by these well-meaning teachers. But I just, and so we were always like almost late or just like a minute or two late. Like I was almost there. Like I was so close, but I just couldn't pull it through in the end and make it, you know, deliver. So then I was always running like 3 minutes late for work and I'd be so mad at myself. Like, why would I be 3 minutes late? That's so dumb. Like, I could have just left 3 minutes earlier, but there always was some little crisis that was like 3 minutes long.
Right.
It's like, no matter what I did, I just couldn't seem to like get it all the way together. So I just remember getting to work one day and I just fell apart because I felt like there was so much stuff that I hadn't done that I was supposed to be doing. Like, I was just failing in small ways on every level. It wasn't like one big failure. It was like everything across the board was failing in some small way. And then I just, you know, that was in large part a, incentive for me to fix my life, really. But, I don't know, like that's a common theme for me though. Like, you know, kind of coming to that breaking point and going, nope, this isn't going to work anymore. I got to do something completely different.
Yeah.
Luckily those moments are fewer and farther between now. I did a lot of learning in my 20s.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
No, I think it's really helpful to share that. I think I'm going to read this one paragraph because I think I just want to read it out loud and it sums up what you just said. And then I want to talk about kind of how you came out of this, but it says, I constantly felt like a loser, like I was just hanging on by a string, but I couldn't seem to get all the pieces of my life to work together. I didn't mind being at my job and liked the people there, but I wasn't particularly inspired by the work I was doing and absolutely hated being in the car for more than an hour every day. I never felt like I was doing enough for or with my boys, but I felt so beaten down by our circumstances that I couldn't find the energy. I mean, that's obviously really honest. And I don't think you're alone in going through times like that where you just feel like no matter what you do, you cannot get it together.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's like, I want to hug you. I want to hug that, that Megan. But you go on in this post and we'll link to it to kind of talk about, you just outlined some basic things that you felt like had to change. And you moved closer to, was it closer to work or closer?
You moved to work and the boys' school.
Yeah. You didn't want to spend as much time in the car and you started to think about ways where that could work. And really this is probably the beginnings of your kind of freelance writing, working from home. So I guess if there's a lesson here, it's that kind of like that rock bottom gave you an opportunity to say, here are the things that I know I want differently in my life. And you kind of listed them out and they didn't all happen right away, but you at least had the kind of like that power in knowing that you'd identified them.
That's true. And I also think, you know, thinking about this, I think sometimes when you're in a real crisis moment like that, the beauty of it is that the things that need to change are pretty simple. They're not necessarily, and I don't mean easy. I just mean they're obvious and simple. They're not really complicated things. Like, I knew part of the reason I was having such a big, every morning felt so frenzied was the drive and, you know, traffic could throw it off by so much time. So it was really hard to gauge that. So I didn't want that anymore. And I didn't want to live in the neighborhood we lived in anymore because it was just kind of depressing and brought me down when I was there. And I, you know, and then that sort of gradually led to me thinking, I don't really want to be at this office all day from 9 to 5. I wasn't able to change all those things right away, but making one little change that made a difference. We switched schools for the kids because the school they were at just wasn't really fitting our needs. It wasn't anything against the school. I'm sure it's a fantastic school, but it wasn't, I didn't like the way I felt when I brought my kids there.
Right.
So that was just another thing. So it was, you know, there's lots of little things and I think I just had to pick one.
Yeah.
And start there. And then
not just say, okay, well, this is the way it's going to be.
Right.
We're stuck
or whatever. I think people feel stuck, like whatever their circumstance is, but you can always change something and then you can always change something else.
Right. Okay, I'm going to read this one more little part because I think this is a great post. But you said, today, I love my life. It's not perfect, neither am I, but it reflects all the things I wanted for myself and my family all those years ago. But what if on that fateful day when my head was on the freezing cold steering wheel in my rusty old Saturn, I had thought, I don't love my life, and then just gone about business as usual? Nothing ever would have changed. So I think there's yeah. whether listeners out there are in one of these really super hard times or have been through something similar or are just tucking it away for future, I think there's some a lot of really good stuff in here and hopefully brings a little inspiration, I think.
Yeah.
Do you have – I think we should touch also on other kind of – bigger.
Well, something that just kind of struck me when you were saying this is that there's always crises you can do something about, and there's the ones you really can't.
Yeah.
So that's like a death in the family. Yeah. You know, I lost both my parents as a mom. There was really nothing I could do about I couldn't really just make that better. I mean, that was going to suck. And definitely there were ways to deal with things that were more or less healthy, I suppose. But that's, I think those kinds of things, a move, a new baby who has colic. I mean, those are the kinds of things that you just kind of got to ride out. I think you surround yourself with people who will support you in the way that you need to be supported, which may or may not include casseroles. Mm-hmm. And I think you just be really kind to yourself. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think I actually may have written a post about when my dad died, and I was, because it happened while I had my blog.
Yeah.
And I was just basically like, you know, hey, I write this whole, and this was when it was the happiest mom. I was like, I write this whole blog about being a happy person, but I'm not right now. So, you know, I think there's that, and we can't really grin and bear it through that stuff. We can't really solve it. There's nothing you can do to change that.
And I think one of the things that comes up during those really terrible circumstances is worrying that the kids are going to suffer or that you're irrevocably messing them up. And I think this is a time when it kind of helps to remember that we're first world, most of us fairly lucky and privileged parents, parenting very consciously and intentionally and buying organic fruit and, you know, thinking about the schools we send them to. And there's a huge room for some slacking off where the kids will still be just fine. Does that make sense? Like we get, we've like, kind of gotten to this place
where we bought ourselves a little wiggle room.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like we have to remember that the standard of acceptable care for children is the basic level, like the bare minimum is much lower than the standards to which we hold ourselves most days.
Absolutely.
So when these hurricanes hit, so to speak, letting everything go and knowing that the kids will be all right. I mean, that's way easier said than done. But if you're someone who's trained yourself to think that, you know, being a good mom means X, Y, Z and
every single day,
every night and, you know, just trust that it doesn't,
And again, it's like we keep coming back to this, Sarah, with every topic we talk about, I feel like, but it's the big picture.
Yes.
It's not the day-to-day necessarily. The day-to-days all add up to the big picture, but you can skip a few. I'm pretty sure in that post about my dad, I said that the kids had gone feral, like all of our, so my sister.
Yeah, I actually did find that post this morning and I wasn't going to bring it up in case you didn't, but.
I want to talk about it. Well, and I think I'm pretty sure my sister essentially moved in with us for like, I don't know, 2 weeks or something. Yeah. So she had all her kids and the kids just ran amok. I mean, I don't know if any of them showered the whole, we were all just dealing with life and like hanging out together. And it was in some ways a really nice time for my siblings and I, and then, you know, in a lot of ways for the cousins too. I mean, I think that they had lost a grandparent. That's never fun. Mm-hmm. But I think there was also kind of a sense of like togetherness and camaraderie that I think was a really special time for them. So I had to really let go of any feeling bad because they ate pizza four or five nights a week and didn't really change their clothes a whole lot during that time. I also think that if you know, with something really critical, there's a crisis like that in your life, teachers want to know.
Yeah.
Other adults in your kid's life want to know because they can help. I mean, they can
totally.
They'll take the kids and go someplace and get them out of your hands. And, you know, I had, I can't remember now who it was, but family friends who let our kids spend the night there. And, you know, they all came back showered and like clean and they probably ate a real meal. I mean, people are willing to do that stuff for you.
That's
and I think
so true.
They would rather know than not.
That's so true. Teachers in particular, if you think of how many students they deal with over the years, they have seen, unfortunately, some pretty crazy, you know, family trauma situations. So in some ways, being a step removed and also experienced in that way, are, you know, can really probably be a safe place for a kid. Yep. just by knowing, even if they don't do anything.
Right. Absolutely.
Do you remember anything else that just kind of, this may not have an answer, but just that kind of helped you or kind of lifted some of the burden in those times, especially I'm thinking of the deaths of your mom and dad?
No, I think time. I think just kind of like going a little head down in it for a little bit and then coming up with ways to kind of just baby step back into my life the way it was.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it would have been really easy just to stay. And I'm not even talking about like grief. I'm talking about just to stay in that sort of disorganized, chaotic state.
Squalor.
Yeah, squalor. At some point I kind of had to just shake myself off and take a step back toward regular life. And it's not like, it wasn't like I did it all in one day. But, and then that made me feel better too. I mean, there's stages of grief and like everyone does it differently. And sometimes you don't get hit by it till a year later and that's fine. And that's normal too. Yeah. But at some point it's like life does go on. It sounds crass, but it does. And so we all have to kind of figure out how to get back into it for ourselves. So,
and I think you'd agree with this too, that if you have the benefit of a spouse who, you know, you can share and be aligned with, that is a great place to start. I'm not like first inclined to just like pour my heart out at the end of the day to my spouse, even though he's very supportive, mostly because I'm tired of talking and it just feels easier to turn on the TV. But every time I do kind of, you know, just unload a little bit, not in a bitching, complaining way, but you can, you know, you can live side by side and co-parent with somebody and kind of forget that you can lean on each other emotionally too. Yeah, and I think that's, if it takes a crisis to really lean on each other, but also I think in the smaller funks, if you have a good relationship with your partner, your spouse, not to, you know, not to forget that that's there. It can be easy when you're in, when there's kids around all the time, but, hey, Free therapy right there on your couch.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like, should we touch on some of the more like postpartum depression, anxiety? I feel like whether or not we have experience, I feel like that's a good place to wrap up and also, you know, probably mention some resources that we are fans of in that area. But have you had any experience with either postpartum or any other kind of clinical?
You know, it's a really good, that's a good question. You know, in retrospect, looking back, I think I did have some postpartum depression with Isaac. Now, here's the thing. I'm not even sure if there's a consensus about whether hormones cause postpartum depression or whether it can be situational or whether it can be lack of sleep or if all those things just add up, you know, kind of combine. So it was very, I was in the stage, he was my second baby, and I was very invested in doing everything perfectly with him. Even more so than I had been with Jacob. And he was a more difficult baby. And we also had moved. We were living in this apartment, like on the third floor in Minnesota in February. And I didn't have any family around. So like all of these things added up to me being extremely depressed for probably like 3 months. Mm-hmm. At the time, I sort of downplayed it. Because I just thought, oh, I'm just feeling kind of in a funk. Like I just don't really feel like doing it. I'm bored. That's, you know. And I'm starting to think now that all those things contribute and it still counts. You know, I wouldn't have said at the time, like I have postpartum depression.
Right.
But looking back now,
right.
I think it's pretty evident I had something that looked like postpartum depression, even if I maybe never would have been diagnosed with clinical depression or anything like that. Yeah, I think so. Another experience I had that was really weird that, again, at the time I didn't really think about having anything to do with postpartum was when William was about like 6 to 8 months old. I went through this crazy phase of anxiety where I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking people were breaking into the house. I mean, I like went kind of just off my gourd for like a month, and John would wake up and see me like running around the bedroom, looking out the window, like hiding behind the curtains and stuff. I was convinced like the train that went by our house was going to derail and hit our house. I mean, I just had all these uncontrollable sort of anxiety thoughts. And finally I woke up and said, do you need help? Like, this is not normal. Something is wrong. And it started to kind of go away after that. Like, I really figured out a way to fall asleep. I don't even now remember how I did it. This was a long time ago. But later I read that there can be kind of like a hormone it was when I was starting to not wean, but he was starting to eat solids.
Yeah, when you said 6 to 8 months, that's exactly what I pictured. Like when your supply goes down, they start to eat a little bit. Yeah.
And there can be some kind of like hormonal shift that can lead to mood swings or differences. And again, like, did I have, quote, postpartum anxiety, unquote? I don't know. And I regret now that at those times I wasn't more aware. I think that that was a term that was thrown around, but it, to me, what I was experiencing didn't look the way I thought that would look.
Isn't that so, I think that is like such a common thing. If it doesn't look like what you've read about in
Which,
a blog post.
Yeah. Or then, those days there weren't even really, I mean, there were blogs, but it was mostly just books and stuff. And I pictured just like a mom holding a newborn, like crying uncontrollably. Yes. And that wasn't me. So I didn't think that therefore I might be suffering with, struggling with postpartum depression or anxiety. So I didn't really look into it. And now I'm so glad that moms now have so many more resources that we can get into in a minute. But I just, those are my experiences. I don't really know what they would be called if I had gone to see someone. And maybe, you know, they worked themselves out and it was okay. But at the same time, I probably could have benefited from, especially in the case with Isaac, because it did go on for so long. I probably really could have benefited from someone to talk to at the very least.
Yeah. Or at least just having the knowledge that other people experience similar things and that it isn't just you like needing to get a life or get out of the house.
Right, exactly.
It's interesting. So with Allegra, when she was first born, I feel like I'd gotten like brochures about postpartum depression and had a pretty good, I was actually starting to read blogs and stuff at that point. She was born in 2008 and I feel like I had started to like, you know, read other writers who were moms and stuff. But I felt like postpartum depression was like this big thing and a very real thing. And I sort of skipped all the parts about the what quote unquote baby blues or the hormonal blues. And the way I understand the difference, at least then, and I think this is still true, is the hormonal blues that can often come right after birth are kind of like a shorter, more intense period of like pretty significant hormonal like blues, whereas postpartum depression tends to come on a little bit later and stay a little bit longer. But I completely like glazed over the hormonal blues part. I knew like signs to watch for postpartum depression, but I had one of the most extreme hormonal dips that I've ever had in any other kind of hormones. I am not like a PMSer really. I mean, get a little grumpy like for one day, but I wouldn't say my, and pregnancy hormones didn't do anything. I knew people who were weepy during pregnancy. I was neither high nor low. I was just pretty normal. And so I had very intense, it felt like a cloud. Like I knew I was supposed to be happy and I had a healthy baby. The birth hadn't been traumatic. Like everything was fine. My recovery was fine. And I knew that I was like happy, but I wasn't. It was very strange. And I'd never experienced anything like it before. And it was probably like 2 weeks in and I cried all the time, like all the time. Even if somebody did something nice for me, like, you know, made me cookies, I would cry. Like they were kind of like those, you know, like happy tears, but it wasn't. It was more like couldn't control the tears. And I think that I hear that consistently. Like when you just, like there's literally water falling from your eyes and you don't know why. And it was a little bit scary. And I mean, it was this, again, this is in the first 2 weeks of motherhood. So everything else has also changed. But finally, toward the end of that, I started Googling like baby center and kind of actually was reassured at how normal that was. And also that for a lot of people, that kind of lifts. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to experience 6 months of depression.
Right.
So I guess for me, like researching a little bit, it actually helped. And it did. It was like, I mean, in the span of 2 or 3 days, the fog completely lifted. So I don't know if that's a normal, like it just, that felt like a pretty extreme hormonal dip. And thankfully, I kind of was able to identify it at least after a week or two. And then about 3 weeks later, it just was gone, totally gone. And I didn't have any other kind of postpartum depression or anxiety. I remember I worried about that happening again when I had my second baby. I was like, I do not want that to happen again. And my doctor was like, well, she's like, probably the fact that you will expect it will make it a lot less. And that was true. I remember having a couple of times where I just kind of cried at the kitchen counter, but it felt more like a just, I'm overwhelmed because I have a toddler and a new baby kind of cry and not this sort of, it felt like just very unnerving. Like it wasn't my emotions. It was like these,
they were being like laid on top of yours.
Yes. It was very strange. And for someone who up to that point had not had any real mental health challenges, it was like, what the,
yeah,
you know, what is happening? And then the other thing I'll add is that I do think I've had shades of anxiety over the course of my adult life and never put that capital A name on it until recently. And mine manifests in physical symptoms, which I know I'm not the only person, because I know people get either headaches or stomach aches. But I on and off will get like a shortness of breath when I'm not like running on a treadmill. And I always kind of like had this hypochondriac worry that I was going to like, you know, have an embolism.
Yeah.
Which really, you know, it's really helpful if you
have anxiety. Yes.
But I've, you know, I've been thoroughly checked out medically by my doctor, and I've just learned a little bit more about that. That is a symptom of anxiety. What's funny for me is I don't always feel like you said you woke up in the middle of the night worried someone was going to break in. Mm-hmm. I can sometimes have the physical symptoms of anxiety when I can check in with myself and I'm not worried about anything. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah, like
I'm
free floating panic or whatever they call it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like non-specific, but the physical symptoms are still there. And so I've tried to kind of connect that sometimes it's maybe after the fact, if I go through a stressful time period, then I might expect some of those physical symptoms to like catch up with me. So it's basically just made me kind of want to take better care of my physical and mental health. But again, I think you made the really good point that these things can look like many different things. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't look like what the pamphlet you got from your doctor, you can either wonder if you're normal or think that it's nothing, but it may just be your way. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think that's so true. I mean, I'm looking right now at the Mayo Clinic's list of symptoms of postpartum depression. It's a huge list that I couldn't even go into, but it's everything from, you know, difficulty bonding with your baby, which I think is a lot of times what we assume it might look like, to anxiety, anger, feelings of shame, worthlessness. I mean, there's just like tons of stuff. Yeah. And even each of these bullet points probably encompasses tons of sub bullet points of how it could look for you. So, I think the point is, if it's just because something is normal or happens to a lot of people doesn't mean you have to just deal with it on your own. I mean, it doesn't mean you just have to suck it up. So if it's something for you that comes and goes without impacting your life too much, and you can kind of get through it, and it's, you know, you give yourself a little space and time, and I don't know, cut yourself some slack, and it passes, then great. But if not, if you're still dealing with it and it's becoming worrisome, there's no harm in looking into further what it could be, even if maybe you won't end up with that as your end diagnosis. Maybe there's something else. Like you were talking about the anxiety. I used to get on Sundays, I didn't really realize this again. This was one of those things I didn't figure out until in retrospect. But when I had my office job and my life was really hard, I used to get like around 5 o'clock on Sundays, my heart would start racing and I would start like panicking, and I couldn't figure out why. I would just be normal. Like I didn't feel bad about it. Nothing was particularly stressful.
Right.
It was just this free-floating thing. And so, that was that postpartum. I mean, my kids were 3 and 5. No, probably not. It wouldn't have been termed that. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a real thing that maybe I could have gotten some help with. So it's worth looking into regardless, I guess, is my point.
I totally agree. And don't you think we've come a long way in where now taking care of our bodies, nutrition and self-care and exercise are kind of glorified, you know, as like taking charge of our health as women. And yet mental health, being proactive about mental health, I don't think has the same sex appeal. I think there's a lot of good resources for when you are struggling and encouraging people to get help. But I also think there's like a proactive side. Like, what do you need to do to take care of your emotional and mental health so that you aren't in a funk, or so that you don't fall into a dip? And that doesn't get as much airtime, I feel like. Do you know what I mean? Like, we go to the gym to keep our bodies strong, or we eat healthy to do X, Y, Z. I think it's great to think about what are we doing proactively to just stay, you know, mentally and emotionally there. So I think I don't know. I've shared this with you. I totally have been like on a self-help kick the last like 6 months or so. So I do think reading, you know, you don't have to go to therapy. Reading great books or reading really inspiring, you know, online writers. Just, I mean, there's apps for mindfulness and meditation you can get. Doing those things, I feel like, isn't necessarily saying, oh my gosh, I have capital D depression, which it's okay if you do. But it's also like, I'm going to floss my teeth every day because then I will avoid gum disease, or, you know. So I think we can reframe how we think about some of those things as not a sign of weakness, but proactive care.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in that note, should we share some resources? I know.
Yeah.
Excuse me. coughing and sneezing and gagging on my own spit. It's really just tragic over here today. One of the ones I obviously wanted to mention is postpartumprogress.com. Yes. That's a great, great resource if you think you may be struggling with postpartum depression, or even if you just want to read about it because maybe it'll help you help someone else. I think it's worth just
knowing more about. Or you wonder if you did, like you. I think sometimes going back and connecting those dots can be helpful.
Yeah.
So even if your kids are 4 and 6, but you just kind of want to understand that better.
Absolutely.
Agreed. So that's postpartumprogress.org. Is that right?
I know. I think it's a .com. Maybe she's got them both now.
Okay. Well, we will definitely link to that. And
if you Google postpartum progress, it's Catherine Stone's site. Yeah. It's great. So yeah.
What else have you, are there any like books or blogs? I mentioned Jessica Michelson, who's, I will link to, she does, I think, weekly emails, and she does some, coaching programs and journaling programs, for women. She's just great. What else? I just read one of Brené Brown's books, and I think her work is great. Her TED Talks and her books are great. Whether you're in a funk or not, I think she's just pretty smart.
I don't want to be too self-serving, but if you go back through the archives of The Happiest Home, we went into lots and lots about self-care and finding more happiness as a mom and getting through hard times.
I think there are like 4 posts about mom funks.
Yeah.
It must have been really.
I was a little funky.
You were funky. So we will link to all of those. But again, even just going to The Happiest Home and typing in search terms. So it is postpartumprogress.com is Catherine's site. And
I think .org and .com both lead you there. So
okay, perfect.
You cannot go wrong.
I feel like there's probably other amazing resources that we're forgetting. I would almost just say that whatever, just find something. Just read
anything.
Something. I mean, go to the library or Google online. But I think we talked about in a recent episode that books are almost less daunting sometimes than a rabbit hole of internet articles. And books are generally by more legitimate people sometimes.
They're more comprehensive, so you just get more depth, which I think is something.
And some of the crap has been weeded out.
Yeah,
like,
and I think what
you and I could write an article about postpartum depression and not be maybe fully...
fully aware.
credentialed to do so.
And I think also like what we were getting at before is it's easy just to read those glossy little snippets about it and then not really understand it. So getting into something more comprehensive, I think, is helpful.
Read.
Also, maybe listeners could give us their recommendations. They could leave a comment on the show notes post,
great.
Which would be at the Mom Hour. But did I just forget? I almost forgot what I was saying. TheMomHour.com. And
I always do that part.
Episode 42. Yeah, I don't even know what the show is called. Sarah takes care of that for me. episode 42, you can leave us a comment. You can always send us an email.
Yep. hello@themomhour.com. And people just share your stories. I think it always feels better to share your stories. And it sounds corny, but if you are experiencing something like this, you are not alone, period. Not only are you not alone, but you're in the club. So welcome.
Welcome.
On that note.
I guess that's a good time to wrap up. Anything we need to add or any housekeeping?
I continue to email us, continue to subscribe and tell your friends. And we've got some fun things in the works for the next few weeks. So just keep coming back. That's all I got.
All right. See you next week, everybody.
Bye.